Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody, again. I am your host, the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. Really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And as a reminder to those that are joining us live, if you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you'll find the chat room. You can roll in there with some of the usual suspects, and that's a great place where in the course of the show you have a question you would like for us to direct to our guest, an observation. We'll both be there monitoring during the course of the show, and we'd love the opportunity to take your good ideas and pull it in. And if in the course of the show you've got to run off because you have other obligations, remember, you can always get this show and all our previous shows at the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can take the shortcut and just get a subscription to the free podcast over at iTunes. But enough of that. Let's go ahead and get on with the show. And today's topic, I think, hits not just a military professional, but those that have loved ones or friends or just interested in it from a variety of angles. And first of all, there's that ongoing discussion about loyalty. You know, which way does loyalty go? Does it go up, down, sideways, all of the above? And it's one of those things that holds the profession of arms together. And when that system is built and you have those relationships, because it's all based upon humans, oftentimes it does not work the way you clinically would expect it to. And what happens when difficult things happen and you have conflicting narratives, conflicting emotions, and perhaps conflicting priorities working within a system, and how that acts on the actual real people and the lives and how they are effective? You know, is there a point as a leader that you have to accept the fact that a structure exists that isn't quite what you thought it was? And ultimately, how does that leader and his people react? How do they expect things to work? And how do things happen sometimes to people in the course of what they think they're just doing their job? And today we're going to talk about the story of Task Fort Violent. It's a great story of inspired unit leadership, some priorities to get twisted up around the chain, and also what happens when men and highly accomplished professionals get caught up in what could basically be called a Kafka-esque experience. And we're going to spend the full hour today with Andrew de Grand Prix. He is the senior editor with the Military Times Group in Washington, and he spends a lot of his time on Marine Corps issues, and he completed this spring a five-part series titled Task Force Violent, The Unforgiven, The Tragic Betrayal of Marine Corps Commando Unit. And he's going to be with us to discuss this as an example of how the military's politically motivated attempt to imprison members of the Marine Corps Special Operations Command after falsely accusing them of killing Afghan civilians during a 2007 battle near the Pakistan border. If you haven't already, you can go over to the show page or on either one of our personal blogs. You can find links to the series if you haven't read it yet, but I highly recommend that you do that. But before I tell more of the story, I'd rather get it directly from Andy. Andy, welcome to Midrats.
Guys. Thanks so much, guys. Appreciate you having me.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time this beautiful afternoon to join us. And just to kind of do a scene setter that I started to touch on there, if you could please, for the listener, describe who was Task Force Violent. Where were they? What was the mission they were doing? And what time frame did this series of events take place in your five-part series?
Task Force Violent was the name given to Marine Special Operations Company Foxtrot. These were the very first Marines deployed to Afghanistan, deployed anywhere really, from MARSOC, which is the Marine Corps' element within U.S. Special Operations Command. So this was a pretty big deal. This goes back to basically the 2006 to 2008 time frame. Fox Company, and I'll kind of use the names interchangeably throughout the hour. Fox Company activated in 06 along with MARSOC. Its first commander was Major Fred Galvin, who is really one of the central characters throughout the course of this five-part series. And it's interesting, you asked about their mission. Their mission ultimately was to conduct aggressive combat operations in eastern Afghanistan. I think unfortunately for these guys, though, that was never really spelled out to them until they were on some Navy ships headed for the war zone. They didn't even really get their orders until it was, really just a few weeks away from putting boots on the ground. So Fox Company got into Afghanistan in March of 2007, and within a month they were out of the war zone entirely, the subject of a pretty ferocious international scandal. Everything really boils down to a gun battle that took place in a village. Its name is Badi Kot. That's located not far from the Pakistan border, as you mentioned, in Nangarhar province. It was a pretty explosive affair. It started off with a suicide strike. Amazingly, none of the Marines were killed. An ensuing ambush took place. And from there, just a lot of speculation as to what played out that afternoon. The Marines, after several minutes, got themselves out of the kill zone and got themselves back to Jalalabad Airfield, which is where they were based. And believe it or not, within a matter of minutes, images from the scene had already made their way into the media and were circulating around the internet. And the early reports from people on the ground, Afghan witnesses, were that the Marines basically went crazy, that they got out of their vehicles and that they targeted innocent civilians. Some people even suggested that the Marines appeared to be intoxicated. It was a disastrous affair. And then, ultimately, all of these claims would be proven false, but from the time that happened, from the time the incident happened to the time that they were exonerated by a court of inquiry, their names were pretty much mud as a result of that. And fast forward to today, it's something that each of these individuals still carries with them in a deeply personal way. That's kind of where we're at.
One of the as I was reading this piece, Andy, the one of the things I thought was really interesting in retrospect is what you just described, that this seems to be one of those asymmetric warfare situations where somebody can stage an ambush, and then when they get responded to it with force, assert that was all the fault of the force that got ambushed, which is what happened to these guys. Is this part of the things that we should be concerned about in the future in this sort of operation?
It's a really great question. Afghanistan, as I'm sure most of your listeners know, was really a different animal. At this time, obviously, you had two wars going on. The other one, obviously, being in Iraq. In Afghanistan, in particular, there was such a premium on the notion of preventing collateral damage, and that's the environment that Fox Company walked into. And actually, I just want to clarify one thing. I think I misstated when they arrived in theater. It was February 2007. They were kicked out of theater by the end of March. But to your question, so much pressure on U.S. forces to limit collateral damage in Afghanistan. It's interesting because, you know, as I mentioned in the preamble here, these guys didn't even know where they were going until they had already gotten on the Navy ships that were going to take them overseas. Once it was found out they were going into Afghanistan, they really had to scramble over the next several weeks in transit to, you know, fully get themselves up to speed on the specific rules of engagement for that theater and the cultural sensitivities that were unique to Afghanistan. Many of these guys had experience in Iraq with you know, force reconnaissance companies, Marine Force reconnaissance companies, but very little, if any, experience whatsoever with Afghanistan. So in a lot of ways, they were behind the power curve really from the get-go. You know, you flash forward to arriving in Afghanistan. It's a very political environment. You know, civilian casualties, the destruction of Afghan personal property was such a tender subject, understandably, of course. But you know, this is what they encountered when they got over there, and you know, really, there are great cases to be made for why the rules of engagement were what they were in Afghanistan. But at the same time, you also have what the impact. You have to understand what the impact is on the U.S. troops who are asked to carry out their missions under those sets of restrictions, and you know. It's such a sensitive subject, and I think as we've seen over the last, you know, decade or more, there have been lots of instances where U.S. troops' actions have been called into question, you know, in very scary, very dangerous situations, and you know, that's something that really affects everyone that puts on the uniform and has to go into harm's way.
One thing that, you know, really got me from the beginning is in many cases you will have a narrative and a counter narrative, especially when you have different cultures and different traditions of how and why one tells an objective truth. But one thing that caught Fox Company flat-footed, and in many cases I think the entire chain of command flat-footed, was the speed of the counter-narrative, counter-narrative being not what the Marines said happened, but what the Afghans themselves said, to the point that before they could even do their after-action report, there was already reports up on open source about what happened. What was the driver behind the speed of the counter narrative, and what was the catalyst that made it move so fast and become really a very powerful, powerful counter narrative?
There were media on the scene, you know, instantly, basically, which I think really set the stage for a lot of what happened, you know, in terms of the, as you said, the counter narrative proliferating. This gun battle happens in the morning. Within minutes, really, they had suppressed the threat. The Marines had suppressed the threat to them, gotten themselves out of harm's way. It wasn't an easy ride by any means back to Jalalabad airfield, but you know, behind them, as sort of the dust settled, you had some freelance photographers on the scene already, and so images were captured of bullet-riddled vehicles, of casualties being put into you know, what appeared to be sort of ambulances. These images were, you know, transmitted within minutes of the attack happening, and made their way onto the internet and into the mainstream media. I think one of the most interesting anecdotes I heard from one of these Marines was, you know, they're in a fight for their lives out there in the village of Badi Kot, and, you know, a half an hour later, they sustained one casualty. It was a minor flesh wound. One of the turret gunners in this six-vehicle convoy was hit with some shrapnel in one of his arms. And so they get back to the airfield, they get back to their base, they take this guy to medical. He's patched up pretty quickly, and as it was described to me, you know, the mood was very jovial. People, the Marines, felt as though they had done what they were supposed to do. You know, they were attacked. They fought their way out. They protected the convoy. They protected one another. They felt good when they got back to base. And as the unit leadership was assembling their after action reports, some of the guys went into one of the chow halls, and, you know, there's CNN or one of the mainstream cable networks already broadcasting what had happened. And the narrative that was coming out was the Marines snapped, they killed innocent people, and that was all being driven by observations made on the ground by the Afghan civilians, and not inclusive of any accounts at that point provided by any of the Marines.
One of the things that got to me in this was the difficulty and these guys had, the Fox company had, in that they were orphans. I mean, nobody seemed to want them. Could you kind of go through that, how they felt themselves eventually, I guess, as redheaded stepchild, I think is one of the descriptions that was in your piece?
Yeah, this is a great point, and it really set the stage for a lot of what befell this unit in Afghanistan, and certainly after they came home. MARSOC was born in 2006, and it was the brainchild, if you will, of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Rumsfeld, and I spoke to him for this series, Rumsfeld was very much of the opinion that just given the asymmetric nature of the war on terror, that special forces were going to be essential to dismantling these pockets of insurgencies. And so he wanted a more robust special operations capability within the military. So he took a look at what was on the table already, and he said we need to do more. And specifically, he noticed the absence of the Marine Corps, and he said we're going to get these guys to participate. That was met with a lot of resistance within the Marine Corps itself, certainly within the senior leadership circles, and that's really no secret. And you know, Rumsfeld spoke with me a little bit about that. He garnered a lot of advice. You know, the Marines were coming back to him, and even his own advisors, and saying, you know, look, the Marine Corps in and of itself is special. It provides a very unique capability to the military's broader portfolio. We don't need to be diluted by this additional special operations force. We don't need to be contributing to SOCOM. And Rumsfeld, you know, soaked it in and basically said, too bad, we're going to do it anyway. So right then and there, you know, you have at the outset this internal resistance to the notion even of developing a special operations force. So as the creation of MARSOC played out in late 2005 and 2006, Fox Company, you know, which was going to be the first unit out of the gate, really ran into one roadblock after the next, and that's supported not only by the guys in Fox Company, but by a lot of the individuals that I spoke with who were around during that time. And it was just a very difficult set of circumstances. The Marine Corps didn't even want these guys. Within SOCOM, you know, the thought was, you know, these guys are just going to compete with us for money. They're going to compete with us for missions. Not interested. So, you know, they couldn't even get, this is very interesting, as Major Galvin, Fox Company's commander, explained to me, and I think this was detailed in the second part of the series, when he was officially tasked as Fox Company's commander by then Major General Dennis Halick, who was MARSOC's first commanding general. The general looked at him and he said, you know, what do you need? And Galvin outlined three things. He said, I need to know what Fox Company's mission is going to be. I need to know who Fox Company is going to report to in the war zone. And I need to know, frankly, what war zone we're going to. At the time, it was thought that, you know, they could have gone to Iraq, they could have gone to Afghanistan, they could have gone to the Horn of Africa. And those answers never came. They never came. And so they were tasked with getting themselves ready. While they were in the States taking part in pre-deployment training, they tried their best to get exposure to both types of environments, that is, Iraq or Afghanistan, you know, as part of their workups. And one thing after the next seemed to set them back. Logistical support became a key issue early on in the pre-deployment phase. Major Galvin, again, the unit's commander, identified that they would need to have some sort of support in theater so that they could function independently. He made requests for several different packages, and a lot of this was built on his experience deploying to war zones and otherwise with force reconnaissance companies. And he outlined exactly what he'd need for, you know, full sustainment, 48 hours at a time, 24 hours at a time, et cetera, et cetera. And he put these in a request to MARSOC. Nothing happened. It ended up that these guys deployed into Afghanistan with one mechanic. They would have a fleet of 45 vehicles. They had a lance corporal to maintain them. And I don't laugh because I think it's funny. I laugh at the incredulity of it all. Along the way, Galvin, he begged the Marine Expeditionary Unit commander who transported him overseas for some logistics guys. No dice. They got into Djibouti before they were taken into Afghanistan, and he found a colleague on the ground there who was reporting back to General Mattis, as it turns out, at Marine Forces Central Command. He said, hey, I'm going into the war zone and I've got no logistics support. You know, can you guys cut loose a couple fellas for me? Sorry, can't help you. They got into Afghanistan finally, and they linked up with the combined Joint Special Operations Task Force there, the entity to whom they would answer to in theater. And it was the same sort of response, just a cold shoulder everywhere they turned, it seems. Once word got back to MARSOC that Galvin was so aggressively asking for assistance, really of anyone he came across, they would send him nasty grams, emails telling him he was out of line, this, that, and the other thing. Finally, they approved what he classified as his minimum support package, which was a logistics staff of six. And I guess MARSOC told him, you know what, pick five guys. I mean, it just, around every corner, there was just some sort of resistance. And I think the grand irony, really, of the whole logistics situation was that once those five guys were finally approved and detailed to Afghanistan, the unit had already been determined, that they were to cease all combat operations and go home. It was very much, you use the term orphaned, and it really was that way, I think, for them, just at every step of the process.
Anybody who second guesses the decision that was made by the Marines back in 08 and 09 that they were going to go into Afghanistan, that they wanted RC South and completely separated from the Army. That's one of the big reasons why, so they could have control over their logistics. And, you know, one thing that I found very interesting, and video is a very powerful tool in many ways to look at inflections, is there's that old cliche in the military about you train as you fight as you train. And in May of 2007, then Army Colonel John Nicholson, I believe he's now a three-star, he put out a pretty quick response that when listening to it, it reminded me of some of the larger exercises that I participated in, where you had, you know, fictitious countries, fictitious geography, and you had your, you know, these situations would come up, and you'd have your PAO that would create talking points. And it seemed straight out of a couple of vignettes for some exercises I was in, where it's almost as if it was a global replace, a very generic, very straightforward. But when you look how things progressed, that was a pretty powerful moment for the Marines in question when they're looking, you know, where is my support, but also when establishing a theme and reinforcing the counter-narrative. Take for a minute to talk about then Army Colonel John Nicholson's video statement and how that helped set the scene early on.
So in the aftermath of the gun battle at Body Cop, it was determined that a command investigation would take place simultaneous to the NCIS investigation. The command investigation was ordered by SOC Sent. At the time, the commanding general was a two-star Frank Kearney, Army. Kearney tapped his chief of staff to conduct the investigation, an Air Force colonel by the name of Pat Pahana. And Pahana was in Afghanistan within days, and he was on the ground looking at all of what played out. His investigation concluded, I think by the end of April, it was approved in early May. It was signed off on by Kearney in early May of 2007. And the video you alluded to was put out by Task Force Spartan. Task Force Spartan owned the battle space where Fox Company was operating in eastern Afghanistan in Nangarhar province. And the commander of Task Force Spartan was, as you mentioned, an Army colonel, now a three-star general, John Nicholson. And Nicholson apparently looked at the investigation's findings, which recommended that several of the Marines be charged with negligent homicide, and concluded that the best course of action was to get out and communicate a sense of remorse to the Afghan people who had been allegedly affected by this situation. And you're right, as the video actually appears in a couple of the parts of this series, because it is very much a turning point. And Nicholson refers to what happened as a, quote, stain on our honor. This really reverberated around the world, if you think about it. The message being communicated, and again, a court date hadn't been set yet, but the message, and by the way, NCIS hadn't wrapped up its investigation. The message being communicated was that that there was guilt here, and this was transmitted. This interview was transmitted back to the Pentagon Press Corps, who wrote about it, after that, it was the topic would come up. I think at the time, General Pete Pace was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He was asked about it on the record and, talked about it being, a ding to the Marine Corps' pride if proven true. The narrative got got out that you know that this had indeed happened, and there had really been no independent investigation of I guess I would say no independent inquiry into the into the command investigation yet. So the common belief was that that you know Marines had gotten into a gun battle and had gunned down innocent people, and it really kind of goes back to not only the Nicholson statement, but also again I think to those images that emerged almost immediately from the battle scene, just leaving and the initial reporting just leaving very little doubt that the Marines had done something wrong.
Yeah, as I was reading your series, and I'm a lawyer, so but I kept hearing railroad whistles in the background. I mean, the train whistles were going off. That these guys, it just looked like a railroad job to me, almost from the get-go. But when it was such a rush to judgment on people who normally should just wait and see. How did part of the thing that changes all this is how did the Marine Corps switch this where they got this board of inquiry, which actually turned the rush to judgment around, except for, in the immortal words of I think it was Ray Donovan, Reagan's Secretary of Labor. Where do these guys go to get their reputations back?
That's the million-dollar question. Fox Company was thrown out of Afghanistan. Major Galvin was stripped of his command. They were brought back to the U.S. And for some of the guys, they were immediately put, you know, right back into the deployment pipeline. Galvin was kind of parked at MARSOC headquarters. He was involved in, you know, some training tasks. The investigation in terms of NCIS continued to play out, and ultimately it was kind of, you know, a recommendation was made to the Marine Corps, you know, based on the strength of or the perceived strength of the command investigation, that again that these guys should face negligent homicide charges, and so General Jim Mattis was the 3-star head of Marine Forces Central Command at the time, and interestingly enough, he elected to convene what's called a court of inquiry, a very rarely used tribunal, which I think in the Marine Corps hadn't been used in about 50 years, and the idea was that you would have a panel of 3 senior Marine officers look at all the evidence, and obviously that would include witness testimony as well. And you know, a lot of that was open to the media. A lot of that was closed to the media. At the time, the explanation given was that there was, you know, given the nature of special operations, there was going to be a lot of classified information that was discussed. And so that stuff couldn't be made public. And to be honest, some of it still remains off the books. There are, I think, approximately 1,500 pages of testimony from the Court of Inquiry that remain locked away. That being said, you mentioned rush to judgment. So this Court of Inquiry begins in January of 2008, and it lasted 3 weeks. Which is, you know, you're a lawyer. You would know that's a pretty long time. And you know, in the course of that, what comes out is a lot of questions with the command investigation. You know, the investigator, again, it was a Air Force colonel, had interviewed weapons experts, for example, about impacts he saw on some of the Marines' vehicles. And as the court would conclude, he didn't like the answer that he got, and so he omitted it from his report. There were just a number of such things that kind of cropped up in the course of this tribunal that, you know, quickly led the panel members to see that the Marines probably hadn't done what they had been accused of. They were deeply troubled by the fact that that the members of the convoy, that their testimony seemed to be overlooked, and at the same time that the testimony provided by the Afghans was kind of taken without real any further scrutiny. And so at the conclusion of this, they made a recommendation to the Marine Corps that the Marines, you know, they probably didn't do everything perfect, but they certainly didn't break the law when they were ambushed on March 4th in Body Cot. And come May of 2008, the three-star general in charge of MARSENT at the time, Lieutenant General Samuel Helland, ultimately agreed and said these guys acted appropriately on the battlefield, and they put out a press release, and that happened to coincide with Memorial Day weekend. That means a 96. That means that while the story got out, not a lot of people saw it. And when you talk about restoring reputations, I think Major Galvin and members of the MARSOC 7, as they were called, would probably tell you that not enough was done by the Marine Corps, by the military, to really set the record straight in the public space. And as a consequence of that, years have ticked by now where, you know, this incident gets alluded to. And it's boiled down to a sentence or two that says, you know, the first MARSOC deployment was a disaster when, you know, this convoy was attacked, and it resulted in allegations of innocent civilians being killed. And, not a lot of media picks up on the fact that, yeah, after all, these guys were exonerated. And so that story still stays out there. It's my hope that through this series, that people now have, when they Google Fox Company the next time, have something that points out that that there are two sides to this story, and it's much more complicated than that.
I want to kind of pull the thread on that, because as I kind of mentioned in my intro, so much of what the military does is based upon something that's not written, it's unwritten, and that is faith in your leadership and your chain of command, that ultimately they will support you when you are right. And as you've outlined very well here and also in your five-part series, the truth of what actually happened has found its way into the light. And if you look at some of the major players here, you have Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Pihana, you have retired Major General Kearney, you have then Colonel Nicholson, who's now a three-star, and you also have then Colonel Haas, who was leading the combined Joint Special Operations Task Force in Afghanistan at the time. He's now a two-star. I know you've reached out to these individuals in the course. You know, what are they looking at in 2015? Are they interested in discussing how this story developed? Were they interested in engaging with you as you were digging up the details, or are they even conscious of the very real impact it's had on our Marines?
With the exception of Major General Haas, who is at SOCOM today, I would answer that question by saying no one was remotely interested in engaging. None of the individuals that you mentioned. General Haas, through and with the assistance of a public affairs officer at SOCOM, did provide a lot of answers to my questions. General Kearney, who retired as a three-star, picked up the phone when I called, and he essentially told me he has no interest, quote, in resurrecting the dead. He personally looks at all of this as a I mean, it's interesting. He referred to it as that it ruined his career. And now I think I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. Pahana, not interested in going back over this either. And Nicholson, his public affairs staff said that, you know, because his testimony remains classified, he's not at liberty to discuss. These guys do not come across very well in the story. Obviously, any reporting endeavor like this, you do your best to tell all sides. And it would have been beneficial, I think, to have these individuals illuminate what they know and how their perspective perhaps has evolved over these last 8 years. It was a bit of a disappointment that they chose not to, although I would say not entirely surprising. General Kearney, he was the commander of SOCSENT. He was the guy that ordered the investigation. He was the guy that signed off on Pahana's investigation, which had a lot of problems with it. And as a result, he came under attack by a congressman, Republican Walter Jones of North Carolina, whose district includes Camp Lejeune. Obviously, there are tens of thousands of Marines at Camp Lejeune. Walter Jones' name would be known to many in the Marine Corps and beyond. He's a member of the House Armed Services Committee. He is a fanatical supporter of rank-and-file Marines. And, you know, I think he was looking at some of the media reports that came out before the Court of Inquiry convened, which really seemed to cast the Marines as guilty as charged. And he stood up and said, this is madness. These guys are entitled to the presumption of innocence. And everyone just knock it off. Not long after that, actually, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, then General James Conway, said something very similar. And that sort of, put this to rest until at least the Court of Inquiry. But in a lot of ways, the damage had been done to the Marines. To get back to your question, though. General Kearney in particular, Congressman Jones really zeroed in on him, requested an inspector general investigation into the general's behavior in relation to this investigation. And General Kearney was cleared, but not before suffering, I think a damage to his own reputation as a lot of questions were raised about, how scrupulous he was in terms of overseeing this situation with Fox Company. And, it's interesting to me that, you ask any of these guys with Fox Company, if they'll ever be able to put this behind them. A lot of them are still struggling with it in a number of ways. It's very interesting to me that General Kearney kind of said the same thing, he views this as, potentially preventing him from picking up a fourth star. He told me that he felt almost pressured in a way by the Marine Corps to conduct the investigation. And I think just wishes that he'd never been a part of it now, take that for what it is. It's definitely an interesting wrinkle in the story. But, some of the quote-unquote adversaries of Fox Company, again, with the exception of General Haas at SOCOM, really had no interest in engaging in the series. I guess you could say, what did they have to gain by doing so?
Well, from the 10,000 foot point of view, one could ask the question whether the Army and Air Force officers involved look at what happened with the Marine Corps Board of Inquiry, which cleared these guys, has the Marine Corps closing ranks around its own folks and and protecting them from what the Army and Air Force folks thought were bad acts. Did you get any vibe like that as you were doing the research on this story?
You know, I reached out to General Mattis, and he declined to speak with me. I think that his perspective would be fascinating to know. Again, the Court of Inquiry, very rarely used mechanism in the military justice system. Why did he want to do it this way? You know, there were a lot of, I think, well understood issues with MARSOC in those early days. You know, did he want to get to the bottom of all that? Was he taking the 10,000 foot view and saying something seems off here? You know, I don't know. His perspective would be very interesting to know, and I hope that one day he chooses to speak about it. In terms of I guess the rest of the service, you know, closing ranks to try to protect these guys, I don't really know. One of the most interesting sources I found for this report was retired Lieutenant Colonel Steve Morgan. He was one of the three senior officers who sat on the court or oversaw the Court of Inquiry. And, you know, in his estimation today, and really not long after the thing concluded, he saw maybe not so much an Army versus Marine Corps dynamic, but really a just kind of a collapse of the notion of what it means to be a military officer and what the obligations of senior leaders in the military, the obligations that senior leaders have when it comes to, protecting their personnel. And, you know, he, I think, provided some of the most poignant quotations, for lack of a better, you know, some of the most poignant narrative of the series. He became very emotional talking about, witnessing what was happening to these guys being Fox Company, and that nobody really stood up to say, this is craziness. How did we sort of betray the obligations that we had as officers? I think more, you know, I think guys like Steve Morgan, certainly guys like Fred Galvin, even some people who were part of MARSOC at the time, probably look at what happened and say that more should have been done. Certainly not everybody feels that way. There were a lot of folks in MARSOC and beyond who simply weren't thrilled with Major Galvin's selection to lead the first company out of the gate, and to this day, you know, look at his actions as somewhat of a failure. But I think more importantly than that, they look at his selection as a failure, and you know that's kind of where the tension remains to this day. Even all these years later, I think again, you know, some people said we could have done it better, other people not so much.
Yeah, I found Morgan's objective witness, it was just like you described. It was very, very powerful to get into one of the really large macro issues. And I mean, I'm glad you brought up Major Fred Galvin here, because I want to personalize it a little bit here, because we are talking about real people, real impacts. If you could describe Major Fred Galvin, what his military career was like. He's now retired. What he does now in the civilian world, and how has he been still involved in trying to get this message out with his Marines today?
Major Galvin's a fascinating individual. He really is. And I want to give you a little bit of background on how this project came to be. Believe it or not, it started with a phone call from Fred. We had included, I think I mentioned this a little bit earlier in the broadcast here, but we had included a line about Fox Company in sort of a retrospective piece about the Marines' experience in Afghanistan. And there was nothing inaccurate per se with what was written, but it wasn't the whole story. It didn't relate the enormity of all of the failures that happened with Fox Company. And Fred read it, and Fred was upset by it, and Fred called us to let us know about it. And in the process of that discussion, he mentioned, having this having recently obtained the complete paperwork that had been compiled by the Court of Inquiry. And he almost issued a challenge to us. He said, come to Kansas, I'll show it to you. And we said we'll be on the next flight. In a lot of detail, and sometimes very emotional detail, we looked at all of this stuff. And Fred, as the commander of that unit, still feels an obligation to go to bat for his guys. And I think he had a lot of discussion with them about the propriety of kind of coming from out of the shadows to talk about this, and really deserves a tremendous amount of credit and praise for doing so. In the course of the interviews that I conducted for this, still a lot of lingering, just difficulty in moving on with life. And a lot of these guys told me that, having this story out there, the complete story out there, in a lot of ways felt like, a giant weight being lifted off them. And so I really, you can't say enough about the courage, I think, that a guy like Major Galvin has coming forward all these years later, recognizing that his Marines are still, kind of toiling away with some personal struggles, and seeing this as an opportunity to set the record straight, to clear the air, to hopefully bring these guys some peace and closure. You asked about his personal life now. He retired in early 2014. This is actually a very interesting anecdote, I think. Upon retiring, even well before he retired, he started putting out feelers for employment. And, to this day, unfortunately, if you plug Fred Galvin's name into Google, this story from 2007 and 2008 is going to come up. And, I think Fred feels that put him in a very tough place when it came to finding civilian employment prospects. He looked far and wide, as he explained to us, and ultimately decided to go back home to Kansas, where he's from. He is currently attending business school. And in the process, found a very interesting line of employment. He started his own business. He owns and operates ATMs all around inner city Kansas City, which is a pretty rough and tumble place, as he described, and I think some of the crime statistics in recent years point out. And Fred relies to this day on some of his military training, certainly in force reconnaissance and special operations, to go out and replenish these machines with money. And he's doing very well. The business has been a success. And, again, it's a very interesting narrative to see that someone who really has struggled personally with all that happened to him and his men, finding a shred of success in the civilian sector. And as a matter of fact, he texted me just a couple of days ago and said that I think it was over the last week or the last weekend, he saw like his biggest day in business since he started operating these machines, and he referred to it as a quote-unquote blessing. He's a very fascinating individual and still trying to do right by his men. And I think, again, he really deserves a tremendous amount of credit for that.
I think one of the other things that your article series reminded me of was the My Lai incident in during the Vietnam War, in which some of the media took that actions of Lieutenant Calley and his platoon squad, wherever he had, to represent the U.S. policy at the time, completely ignoring one of the great backstories, the story of Chief Warrant Officer Hugh Thompson, who got in there and put a stop, as much as he could, put a stop to what was going on. How long did it take to get Thompson and his crew recognized for the effort they put in? It took a long, long time, and I hate to suggest that that's the case for these Marines who've been whitewashed here with this message from the media in some cases that they did something wrong. But have they ever discussed that? How long do they look forward to vindication, if any?
That's exactly what they hope for. Absolution, I think, is the word I've heard. In one of the discussions we had with Fred, he talked about changing units after this incident, and even after the Court of Inquiry, and people would come up to him and say, "So, how many civilians did you guys kill?" And it was determined they didn't kill any innocent civilians. This narrative has continued to perpetuate itself, and they want recognition that not only were their actions appropriate, they didn't do anything wrong. They did what they were trained to do. They did a good thing. They protected one another. They protected their convoy. They adhered to the rules of engagement. They are deeply hopeful that the Marine Corps will look at the fact that their story has been told now and kind of bring them back into the fold. We wrote an editorial here. I did not write it personally, but our organization wrote an editorial at the conclusion of this series, and we made note of the fact that MARSOC is coming up on its 10-year anniversary. That would be next year. And what an opportunity, really, if you think about it, to make a statement. Obviously, things did not go the way people had initially hoped with the first unit out of the gate. But how do you tell the history of MARSOC without alluding to Fox Company? And when the 10-year anniversary comes around, how is that story going to be told? It could be a golden chance, a golden opportunity for the Marine Corps, for MARSOC, to kind of bring these guys back in, show them a sign of embrace, and hopefully take another step towards promoting their health and healing.
That's a perfect lead-in, just kind of to wind things up here. I wanted to do kind of a longish quote from part five of your series, and quote, "Collectively, the fallout left them physically sick, psychologically broken, and deeply embittered towards the leaders they blame for causing and perpetuating their anguish and shame, including men who have earned general stars. For some, like Galvin, there have also been lasting professional setbacks, too. But the betrayal from within that shattered their trust in the institution, it defied the core values instilled in these men from the moment they joined the Corps: honor, courage, and commitment." Interior quote, "This still haunts us," one of the Marines explained, "because no one has publicly acknowledged we did the right thing that day. We did our jobs, and we were crucified for it." end of longish quote. I'm curious, now that this has been out, hopefully it's gotten as broad exposure as it have, what type of feedback have you gotten from the Corps, from the Marine Corps, any indications of any action they may take moving forward? And in a larger sense, what other interest have you got in the story? Because it's a powerful story, one that you would, you know, expect to see a book, or it would be great for somebody like Clint Eastwood to get hold of something like this. I'm not exaggerating, because it really hits a lot of different levels. So that's what I wanted to put over to you. Talk to us about, as we end things up, you know, what have you heard inside the Corps and outside of our usual knitting circles that we talk about these things? Anybody there?
I'm here. I don't know what happened to Andy.
Oh, looks like we lost Andy. Well, I guess Andy, you there? Going once? Going twice? Okay. Well, I guess we'll have to wind it up. Eagle One, thank you very much. And we'll just have to leave that question out there and hanging.
Yeah. Well, it was good while it lasted. It's too bad you didn't get the last question answered. Maybe we can have it back sometime.
My vote is technology is what it is. Well, thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. Hopefully this has encouraged you to go back, read the full series, and share it with some people you know. And until the next time we see you on Midrept, hope you have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.